The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 252.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show, a first-time guest, someone I've really looked forward to speaking with. I listen to him all the time on Real Vision, and he is an expert trader. And I don't often get the opportunity to speak with traders. Usually it's more long-term investors. So I'm really excited to talk to Tony right now. Also, he's an expert in the commodity space. So I want to dive right into that. So Tony Greer, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
George, thanks for having me, man. I'm really honored to be here. I've been a long-time listener of your work, and I'm really thrilled to be here to chat with you today.
Awesome. So tell us about your background a little bit. How did you get to where you are? How did you get to become an expert trader?
Yeah, I would say, George, I was bent on trading from the time I got out of school. My dad was, I'm a second generation trader, to be honest, right? My dad was an over-the-counter trader for equities for Dean Witter for 30 years. So trading was like dinner table conversation for me my entire life.
Yeah.
So, you know, I knew what Microsoft was when I was 12. I knew what bid offers were when I was 15. And, you know, I started to get into the competition side of, you know, seeing how happy my dad was at work every day. And so that's what led me into the markets. And, you know, I started off determined to get a job on a trading desk. I started off in foreign exchange on the 107th floor of the World Trade Center working for Sumitomo Bank, which was really cool. Yeah, really cool experience to get started off in FX working for a foreign bank. I went from there to UBS for 2 years. I traded currencies and commodities there. And from that post, I got sort of a lot of touch points on the market and was able to meet some great traders at Goldman Sachs that I wound up becoming close with. And I got hired eventually there in 1994 to the J. Aaron division of Goldman Sachs. And sort of that's where I started training for my black belt in commodities, essentially, as I would put it. You know, since you join the ranks of J. Aaron, you realize that you are, you know, working at a very serious commodity trading shop where you're managing risk literally 24/7 for 5 days a week, you know, while the markets are open. And you are learning about the rigor and the volatility that is involved with trading commodities, you know. And so that was my initial, you know, introduction really to trading commodities and trading precious metals there. So I started off trading the Goldman Sachs Commodities Index, which was a basket of 22 commodities, world production weighted. So it was mostly energy, oil, et cetera. So that's where I got like the basics of my education. But trading that commodity index, I got an unbelievable look at, you know, customer flows, you know, understanding a broad base of different types of commodities, understanding the future side of commodities as we had obviously spread positions, you know, running big books there. And that was really, you know, managing that book is where you get to learn each commodity has its own personality, has its own market of players, and you figure out how to create your network that really plugs you into all the various sectors of the commodity world that you need. And sort of, you know, that network that I created and the sort of screens that I created in the mid 90s while working at Goldman Sachs, J. Aaron, that network is the same network that I tap into today, you know, to gain insight on what's going on in the commodity world.
Why is time horizon important? And the reason I ask that question is because, you know, I just spoke with Chris Cole, I believe it was last weekend or the week prior. And part of our conversation revolved around the importance of portfolio construction. And I told Chris that so many people that comment on my videos or I talk to in the live streams, they get hyper focused on just what is the price going to do of XYZ asset. And they totally ignore portfolio construction. They ignore their time horizon. And I think it should be the opposite, that they should place even more emphasis on the portfolio and how the assets interact with one another, but also their time frame. It's so much, you know, you could say that you're extremely bullish on commodities or oil, and you could be referring to the next 3 weeks. And then someone else like Jim Rogers might be referring to the next 10 years. And it's apples and oranges, and people conflate the two. So from a professional standpoint, why is that important? And to choose one and then to understand what it is and then stay in your lane.
Oh boy, great question, George. Staying in my lane has become my specialty because I learned that when I step out of it, I get burned. So staying in your commodity lane, but let me get right directly to your question about, you know, time horizon. You brought up a good point about, you know, whether somebody's trading short term or long term.
Right.
And the way I try to approach that is to have my long term view, you know, constructed within the market. I want to have my portfolio for the long term match my fundamental view of the market. And then the timing of, you know, whether I'm bullish or bearish a commodity for a period of time is very much for a specific trade entry point where I say, okay, now I want to ride this trend that I believe I've got right fundamentally for a trade from point A to point B, right? And for me, it's when the risk reward lines up in price much more than the time, but that's when I'll start getting into a trade and start placing, you know, when I start a trade, George, I put on stop loss, you know, say I'm buying something to get long, I put on a stop loss below the market, a target above the market, and I also have an egg timer on the position, right? Because time kills all trades. So if you tend to be in a trade over a long period of time that's not doing anything, not performing, that's when I kind of check myself and decide whether or not that trade should be exited in the interest of entering something else that I may have on that's performing better.
Right. There's an opportunity cost there.
Yeah, exactly. So kind of that's how I look at it. For me, time frame is kind of I'm in a trade for as long as the market lets me be, to be quite honest with you. You know, I've tried to maneuver into a trade with the opportunity to leave a trailing stop loss so that I let the market take me out. You know, that's kind of the way that I've battled becoming better at exiting trades. You know, that was a struggle for me for a long time. And then I finally developed a system where if I'm right, I just keep bumping my stop loss below. You know, and sometimes, you know, you don't, with that in that scenario, you don't know whether you're going to be in a trade for 2 weeks or 2 months, right? Because sometimes the trend just keeps going and you keep rising your stop with the markets and you stay alive. So, you know, that's kind of how I play the time factor of the commodity markets, if that's fair to say.
Yeah, for sure. So do you have a core long-term position that you don't touch and then you just trade around that? Or is it just trading back and forth with that long-term view, kind of that macro overlay?
So the way I work it in my newsletter, George, is that I run a view matrix, right? My view matrix will take positions that I start off with usually on the bottom of the view matrix, which is a radar screen. The radar screen will tell you, you know, I've been watching these sectors. You know, I've decided that these are the sectors I want to pile into because they're telling me that they're performing, right? I'm studying them on a daily, weekly, and monthly closing basis. And I'm generally shuffling the winners into my radar screen saying, okay, for example, metals and mining, energy, natural resources spaces started performing, you know, at a certain point last year. Okay. You know, and so those performances guided me into these sectors, right? So it's like I'll bring those sectors from the radar screen up into the view matrix when I say, okay, it's time to have this trade on, right? Like we were at an entry point, we're either at a breakout point or a value level technically where I could put on a trade, and then we'll go ahead and manage the risk reward from there. So it's pretty methodical about number one, a pretty methodical system about number one, following the market's performance, so that I don't find myself imposing my view on my book so much. And I'm very much letting the market lead me into it. And then, like you said, about the real timing for a trader like me is, you know, I've been bullish oil for a year, but I've been in and out of long positions probably 6 or 8 times over the course of the year where I'll say, okay, this is an opportunity where I can catch a $5 oil trade, you know, and kind of that's generally how I'm managing my book.
My guess is 90% of the people that try that strategy, basically market timing with a long-term view, lose all their money. That's just my guess. Let me know if I'm wrong. But if I'm correct there, what mistakes do people make that they just go in at the wrong time? They get emotional. They don't watch their stop losses. They They turn it into kind of like, I've got a hunch, I'm using emotion instead of setting up a system. I always reference back to my days playing blackjack. And yeah. I'm sure you've read the Market Wizards books. And yep. That's one of the things that struck me first reading that first Market Wizards books is almost every single one of those guys started off in blackjack. Yeah. And you kind of say, okay, well, why? Well, what they did is they just took the core principles of blackjack and applied that to trading options or stocks or currencies, what have you. And so what I'm saying is it's rules based, and you yeah. have to have a rules based system. And if you don't, from what I'm speculating, you're most likely not going to have an edge. Therefore, long term, you're most likely to lose money. Is that safe to say, or am I wrong there?
No, George, I would say that developing a system of at least core risk management is absolutely necessary in terms of survival as a trader, right? And I talk about survival as a trader because, you know, the whole you learn at a very young age is that the idea is to stay alive, right? And you know when you sat down at Goldman Sachs and Jay Aron, you know, you knew that the guy that was sitting down there that's been trading oil for 40 years has managed to evolve with the markets and stay alive in the markets, right? And so that's the way you look at things and you say, okay, no matter what, my goal number one is I don't blow myself up, right? And so you start with that. But I've developed a system, George, that, yeah, I would say just piling into markets is a way to go broke. You know, I've developed a system where I'm really very much developing patience. And, you know, once I decide that I want to get into something, you know, I've done my homework. I decide that the oil market is constructive and I think it's got a long way to go. Then I'm really applying my technical analysis overlay and saying, okay, well, I've got to be patient until it gets to a level that I can buy it, because never am I going to, you know, have completed my homework on a trade, decide I'm going into it, and also have the price sitting there at a place that I want to trade stock or trade a commodity. You know, it's always a waiting game, and it's either, you know, I'll force myself into a position either by forcing myself to wait for it to depreciate to a certain level or break out on the upside to a certain level, because I've had some success as a momentum trader and I figured out how to manage that type of risk. So, you know, there's all different ways to skin the cat.
Yeah. How do you balance staying in the game and managing that risk, but then also having the balls, for lack of a better term, to take action? And what I'm referring to is, I remember a conversation I had with a guy that I met in St. Bart's through my good buddy, Hugh Hendry. And this gentleman, I won't say his name because he likes to keep a low profile, but you'd recognize him from CNBC, hedge fund manager, managed billions of dollars. And we were having dinner one night and he was telling me the story of how he became a hedge fund manager. And I believe he was working at a firm in Asia or something like that. And he was just, you know, he was very young. And he just kind of forced his way into the conference room during these big meetings. And finally they said, okay, kid, here's whatever, $1 million, you know, go see what you can do. And they gave him $1 million. And they also gave a lot of their top research analysts $1 million. And he said that the reason why he became successful and all those other people didn't, even though they are 10 times smarter than he was, is because those research analysts knew all the facts. They knew all the data, but they couldn't pull the trigger. So at the end of the 2 months, they still had the $1 million, but they didn't make a trade, where he had the nuts, the huevos, to go in there and say, give me $1 million, give me 10 million, give me 100 million. And I'm going to go ahead and execute the trade that I think, because I've got the confidence in myself to take action. And those seem like the polar opposite of one another, but yet they both seem necessary. So how do you balance those two?
You know, well, let's go back to, this applies directly, in my opinion, to your blackjack analogy.
Yeah.
Right. As a trader here, you know, it's difficult to draw the exact metaphor. But as a trader, you're really kind of, you know, when you're looking at the markets, you're sitting around waiting for an opportunity to when you get to split tens, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, all of a sudden you see how, wait a minute, now the odds now changed for the price of this to go in this direction because something just happened, you know, and it's learning. It's learning that reaction mechanism and how to read a market's response to data, right? It's very much learning something like that. For example, when you get confidence to stay in a stock during a bull run when they're reporting mediocre earnings, but the stock is rallying. Mm. You notice that relationship. Earnings are coming out. They're kind of a mixed bag, et cetera, but the market likes the stock and the stock is going. And you'll notice the difference when all of a sudden it gets to a period that stock starts beating earnings and the market says, meh, that's not so great anymore, right? Like, right. You know, so you learn to say, okay, this is what's happening with this stock. This reaction to data is changing. So my odds that its behavior is going to change have just dramatically gone up, right? Now I'm splitting tens against the six.
Yeah.
You know, and so those are the opportunities that you want to get yourself into. And, you know, it's very difficult, but everything that I learned at J. Aaron from the guys that taught me was, you know, you get to put your chips on the table when the stars line up. Mm-hmm. Right. And when the stars line up and you'll see, okay, there's one more thing, you know, for example, I'm long commodities. I want to look for a chance to step on the gas. Right. Well, today the dollar is down. That's not going to hurt me. Right. That gives me confidence to step on the gas. Today grains are rallying and metals are rallying. So that gives me a little confidence to step on the gas and other commodities because the asset class is working. Right. So you learn in the market, there are these different little nuances, and then you'll wake up other mornings and see something like the bond market going against you and say, oh, man, it's going to be a bad day for what I have on. Right. And then you're on to playing defense. But, you know, you get to switch from defense to offense when the market, sort of the market dealer, if I may, deals you those hands where it looks like the dealer is about to break and sometimes go on a string of breaking. And so that's really how I'm looking for that edge in the market where, you know, you get a couple of, we've been using the oil analogy, you know, the chances where the opportunities to step on the gas, where you continue to get draws in the oil markets, you know, and you're long and you'll see the inventories dwindle down. You know, those are chances to sort of stack your bets up when you're in a trade and you want to add to it. So those are the sort of signals that you have to learn to read and then also read, you know, conversely, when the dealer flips over, you know, a 10 and you're sitting there with your two, right. You know, that's the time to shrink up the risk and say, you know, I really don't want to fight you today. Thank you very much.
Yeah, exactly. How do you manage the emotional roller coaster? Because it's one thing to sit here and talk about it. I think everyone can read this in a book and say, you know what, that makes a lot of sense. But to actually execute, I mean, you got so much experience. I'm sure it's far easier for you. But I'm sure it's something you actually had to learn, even though your father was in the business. So how did you learn to manage that emotional roller coaster to make sure that you're making rational decisions and not knee-jerk reactions? And what tips would you have for the average Joe and Jane, regardless of their time horizon, to manage their emotions better?
Man, that's a great question, George. So emotions are, you know, the enemy of all trades.
Yeah.
Right. You know, if you can, you know, the whole idea being, if you can keep your head while those about you are losing theirs, you are going to be in really good shape as a commodity trader. Right. You know, you kind of just bend that old saying. And, you know, so you're looking for those periods of volatility where you get to pray with an E, where sort of something falls into, you know, your execution strategy. You know, markets are moving quickly and you get to trade and sort of see a trade through the way you saw it happening. Right. So that's something that happens when the markets are going fast. But to take the emotion out, what I've tried to do is make everything a calculated bet with a binary outcome, you know. And so, you know, if I'm bullish home builders, I've been in situations, for example, where I've been bullish a sector for 3 months and not gotten the opportunity to get into it. Right. And once you get the opportunity to get into it, all you're really doing is saying, OK, I'm putting on, a 4-to-1 ratio bet here because I'm going to bet at from this price that it's got a chance to increase, you know, say 20% where I can put a stop loss 5% below the market. Mm-hmm. And now I've basically taken the emotion out. Yeah, right. I've got a binary. I've got a stop on the downside that I know that I'm getting out. I've got a target on the upside. I know that I'm going to have to manage things in between. But if I have those two data points and I'm watching closely, I've taken a lot of the work out of the trade and a lot of the heart and the sweating to the point when you realize that selling out of a loss is a very regular and natural thing to do as a trader, you become friendlier to accepting the losses, right? When you look at your, when you look at your ability to gauge markets and say, okay, even if I'm a great trader, I'm going to look to be right 55% of the time,
right?
Because I'm going to be able to stack those bets when I see them going my way. But at the same time, you want to be able to take, you know, the emotion out so that when it doesn't go your way, you've just got one plan, right? The ejector seat plan. And you have to understand that that is part of trading. And if you have a system for, which I do, getting into a trade, staying into a trade, monitoring a trade, like I've developed over time, I've basically, you know, I put my positions on and then I kind of sit back like this until it triggers, until something triggers, right? A take profit or a stop loss. Of course, we're managing the whole time and taking in data points, but I really want to take as much emotion out of it so that I say, yeah, my bet is, this stock goes, you know, it's at 45. My bet it goes to 50 before it goes to 44.
Yeah, right.
And so, you know, that I don't need to be emotional about that. And once you realize that you're really just in the casino playing each hand, losing some, winning some, losing some, winning some, you know, your winning trades perform for you. And if your system is set up right, they're going to do the work and they're going to generate the, you know, the income, and your system will keep you in it long enough to outweigh four or five losers. Right. And so you just have to accept the point. This is one of those losers, get out of it. You know, and that's really how you take emotion out of it, is have binary outcomes and not always, and always understand that the market is not always going to do what you thought it was going to do. That's really the short answer.
Yeah. It's like, you've got to program your brain to, thinking there, or you've got to reprogram your brain to believe that a job well done or trading well or investing well has nothing to do with your P&L, but it's if you followed the rules of the game.
Yeah.
So the measurement of success, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, is how well you play and not your P&L. Because, and if you're able to, it seems very counterintuitive, but if you're able to do that over the long run, you're going to have a mathematical edge. And ironically enough, your P&L will most likely be a hell of a lot better than if that's your initial focus. Is that accurate to say?
Totally. That's a great way of backing out of it, George. You know, everybody's got a system for playing cards, and it's like the same thing where, you know, when I play blackjack, my idea is to stay alive for 6 hours, because I know that during that 6 hour period, there'll be 10 or 15 minutes when the dealer is just caving in. Yeah. Right. And yeah, that's when you're like, oh, this is actually it. Like, she can't win a hand. You know what I mean? And you learn that and you feel that. And so that's what trading becomes. You know, trading becomes staying alive until you can say, okay, this is one of those times, right? So put my bet in the circle. If you get blackjack, you take my money. You know, and it's just constantly applying that over and over. And you realize that just stick to the system. The system works, right? Mm-hmm. It's like any sports team. I heard you say that you're an athlete, you played hockey, you played golf. But, you know, either sport, it's always like, look, if you stick to the fundamentals over the long run, you're going to outperform guys that aren't sticking to the fundamentals, right? Or aren't doing the training. It's the same way. If you're applying your system and making sure that you are cutting losses and letting profits run, which is your job as a trader, and you've got to figure out how to do that. But if you stick to that knitting, in the end, the score will be fine, because you started off by, the starting point is protect the nest egg at all costs, which means when stop loss levels are hit, you get out and there's nothing to talk about.
Would you rather, I'll take it one step further. Would you rather take a, let's say, a 5% loss while abiding by your rules, or have a 20% gain while breaking the rules?
I usually try to take, you know, I'd rather stick to the rule book, man.
Yeah,
you know, and a 5% gain, a 5% loss to me is like water off a duck's ass. Yeah. I can't even tell you how many times I lose 5%. You know, George, I have some rules about entering trades where, you know, if I get into a trade on a Tuesday or Wednesday, I have an expectation set for Friday's close. And if it doesn't reach my expectation in some way that to show that that trade is performing, I just get out, right? I just get out. Sometimes it's a 5%, sometimes a 2% loss, sometimes it's a 2% gain, but I always have some kind of a minimum level of saying, okay, I got into this on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. If it doesn't close here Friday, or God forbid below this price, I am gone. Right. Right. And those are usually very tight, like windows, right? Like it's only a level, a trajectory that the stock is going to get to in 2 days, right? So how far can it go? And, you know, I'm always giving it a really short leash. Like I get out of more positions on the Friday close just because I'm not that impressed than I can even care to tell you. And it's really just to stay alive so that I can come in Monday and play offense again.
Yeah.
You know, it's staying alive for things like that.
Yeah, I think I was able to beat the dead horse sufficiently, but I think it's so crucial. And that's why I know it's kind of maybe boring for some people, but hopefully it really has an impact, because it should be very profound and just a mindset shift in probably 99% of the people that I see commenting. So understanding what we're talking about, looking at the legends, you know, the Druckenmillers, the Jim Rogers and whatnot, all the guys and gals and market wizards, and then your experience as a professional trader and using rules-based systems, trying to eliminate emotion from the equation. How, if that's your framework, if that's the lens that we're looking through, how do you view what's happening right now with the meme stocks?
Oh, I literally have disdain for them, to be totally honest with you, right? Like for me, I stay in my lane to the point that like I won't even know what the meme stock ticker stands for until I can't stand seeing it in my Twitter feed.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, right. Like it's just one of those, like, I didn't even know GME was GameStop until, you know, I didn't know what GameStop was until the whole thing had already gone berserk. If there's one thing I've learned, George, and that I'm whether it's good or bad, but I practice it, is I have a noise cancellation policy that is impenetrable. So when I'm focused and dialed in on my natural resources, transports, energy trades, there is nothing that you can put in front of me that is going to detract my attention from that. Mm-hmm. There is no AMC option. There is no, you know, there's no play. There's no Wall Street bet on the board that I care more about than managing the positions that I know how to trade, that I know how to interpret tailwinds and headwinds of. Yeah. So my noise cancel, you know, for that stuff, I turn it off. I realize I've had a great conversation with Dimitri Kofinas about it, about how it is very much, you know, total nihilism, you know, toward proper risk taking, toward proper money management, toward, you know, just being sensible with your cash. And yeah. So I kind of turn it off. I stay away from it. And, you know, I just let those guys play in that sandbox and stick to the lane that I'm in, because I find more times than not, if I try to jump into that pool, I wound up getting burned immediately, you know, and I learned that decades ago, you know, that whenever the stock is the most popular stock in the room, I'm usually running the other way. That's just the way I operate.
Right. Okay, cool.
I
wanted to kind of dive into your macro view. I was listening to you on Real Vision the other day talk about how you're extremely bullish long-term commodities. I know a lot of my viewers and listeners would fall into that same category. So let's start with the macro view on inflation, deflation, commodities, the dollar, et cetera.
Okay, so I've been secular bear in the dollar to start off. You know, I know that it's a popular view. I would say I've held it since, you know, the light bulb went off and the Federal Reserve took their balance sheet from $4.5 trillion to $7.8 trillion now. Mm-hmm. You know, that began last year. And to me, that was the biggest financial news story of the year, right? Yeah. Like that was the biggest thing that I've ever seen happen in markets. You know, the biggest economy in the G10 just absolutely taking on an unbelievable, unsustainable, probably amount of debt. So you say that that's bearish the dollar, right? A bearish dollar is going to have commodity, is going to be a tailwind for commodities. So I've been extremely bullish BCOM. I've been bullish oil. I've been bullish base metals. The problem that we're getting to now is that it's a front page trade. It's a front page of the news.
That's what I wanted to talk about. That's my thinking as well. I'm very bullish, and I'd like to buy more and increase my position because I took a big position in March 2020. But great. I'm like, man, everyone's on one side of the boat. And that's where I start to feel very, very uncomfortable. So I wanted to get your professional opinion on that as well.
So I think right now there's two dynamics to watch out for. First is China. Obviously, we have to have an eye on them. Now, when they say that they are going to try to stem speculation and excessive trading in commodity markets, I always call bullshit on that because I don't think that they can, for more than a day or two, hold back the tsunami of commodity flow. So the thing they can do, however, is affect the yuan very directly. And I think that that's something that they may have done today, right? We saw a huge move lower in the yuan today, higher in the dollar. Commodities got wrecked except for oil, right? So I think that while they realize that they probably can't control the natural flow of commodities, wagging the dollar is probably an option, right? So they may have sort of sold yuan into the markets to depreciate that a little bit, cause the dollar to rally. That right. takes a lot of air out of the commodity markets. Yeah. So that's one thing to just keep an eye on, right? The second thing is really managing the positioning. Because now that, we've been in this, March 2020 last year, the balance sheet trade, knowing that hard assets were going to be the right way to go coming out of that lockdown scenario, going into the green economy that we're trying to, however this is going to go, it's going to go, but we are going to be inhaling commodities at a ferocious pace to try to implement this green deal, right? So what we're going to have now is a seesaw between the commodity markets rallying, in a big crowd and getting overcrowded. And then all of a sudden, we're going to see the everything shortage on the cover of Barron's, and we're going to see commodities back off because that is going to be a sell signal every time. The reality is that they're probably going to continue to find a level and continue to rally, because I feel that the dollar decimation or the fiat currency decimation, if you will, because it's not always just the dollar that is going on, lends itself just for people to continue to position for an inflationary environment. And, like in some conversations I've had with Grant Williams, we don't think that the big plain vanilla behemoths have changed their portfolios for the next 10 years of inflation yet. So that's sort of the big decision that you have to undertake is to, like we started off with, is to get your portfolio, focused into those lanes where at least you've got some commodity exposure. Like we said, it's going to be managing the fits and starts. You're going to see commodities blow up to extremes, get way away from their moving averages. And then you're going to see everybody's too long and they'll pull back into the moving averages. People will think the rally is going to end. And then the next thing you know, the dollar will get bombarded again and commodities will catch a bit. So that's kind of the way I've been playing it and the way it's been playing out. But we're in a position right now where we've got China, we've got the Fed talking about potentially, unwinding some of the balance sheet. So all of these things are kind of shaking up the risk complex right now. Yeah. But I think broadly speaking, with what's going on at the Federal Reserve, hard assets are going to have to be the way to go for the next 10 years, if you ask me.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
How much attention do you try to pay to capital flows Or does that really go into your decision-making process?
I don't know. I don't have a good enough handle. I don't have a good mechanism to follow it. And it's not one of my, you know, sort of bread and butter ways to follow the market. So
you're just
kind really is
trying to see that through the technicals.
Yeah, mostly through the technicals. You know, I'm really into sentiment and narrative timing of trades, you know, kind of understanding, you know, what the market is trading on. And then understanding, you know, when sentiment gets tilted too far and I'll get an opportunity to get into a trade or something like that. So, you know, I've been good with reading sentiment in the commodity markets and being able to be patient, you know, waiting for some levels. But at this point, I've got a lot of length on for a long time now. And so it's one of those egg timer trades where you're like, man, you know, it feels like it should be a time to maybe liquidate part of that trade and fold your arms and see what happens next. You know, because the beauty of it is that you can always buy the commodities back. I'm a momentum trader. So that's a very natural thing for me to sell something and see it go up 1 or 2% and say, wait a minute, get me back in there. This thing is working again. You know, that's not a trade that I'm afraid to do. And sort of, I guess, as a floor trader sort of with experience on both the New York Stock Exchange floor and the New York Mercantile Exchange floor, you become very transactionary trader, right? So there's no hesitancy. There's no analysis paralysis. Everything you're doing is very like, okay, I'm going to buy this here and I'm going to sell it very soon at another price. You know, sometimes it's going to work, sometimes it's not. So I think that's kind of, you know, how I'm used to playing the markets, which is why I've been able to stay alive in some good trades.
You've got a long-term view that's very bullish on commodities. Let's specifically point out oil. When you're going in and out, are you just going in and out on the long side, or would you go in and out on the short side as well, even though your long-term view was bullish?
I trade almost nothing from the short side, George.
Okay.
I'm very, very picky with that. And when I say almost nothing, I say that, you know, I understand that I want my book to have some balance, right? Mm-hmm. To not just be a long all commodity stocks all the time. But what I'm usually doing is picking on another sector to short that isn't performing because it broke down below a technical level. Like we've seen solar stocks do that. We've seen, you know, Tesla's beginning to do that. So I found some names in tech that are very clearly curling over, and I can at least assign good risk reward on the chances that they'll back off. So I usually pick on tech to be short while I'm long the natural resources trade. And the reality is, though, George, I learned a long time ago that if I stick to trying to buy securities that are going from the bottom left to the top right hand corner of my screen, I have a really much better chance of knocking something out in the middle of that trade than I do if I'm saying, okay, let's be long this here and then be short it here and then be long it here. Like, my brain cannot work like that. Yeah. You know, so I'm like, you know, this thing is going this way and we're going to sort of see where the right time to jump on and ride it to a higher price is. And then we're going to get out and try to do that again. Right. That's very much the way that my brain works.
Okay. So it's not necessarily a commodity trend type of strategy, because that would imply that you're like from 2000, what was it, 11 to 2019 or 20 or so, that means that you're just trend, you're doing the opposite, but on the short side. But
yeah, that's not, I can't trade that way. I can't trade commodities that way. No. So this, you know, for whether it's good or bad, it didn't feel great while we were being locked down economically. But I was literally like a kid in the candy store when oil was going towards zero. Yeah. And I literally have friends calling me up saying, does this mean that we're going to go to the gas station and it's going to be free?
Or they're going to pay you to take it. It's negative 40.
Yeah. And you're going, Jesus Christ, you know. And I'm calling up my friends at the JR and commodities desk and saying, can you make me a price on my lifetime supply of gasoline right now? I'll buy it all right now, you know? Right. And so, you know, so you start legging into that oil trade. And so that I've still got that on. And that's only because it's the kind of thing where I've got a trailing stop below the moving averages, and oil just has not traded below the moving averages for 10 months now.
Right, right.
You know, so that's kind of the way that, you know, when my winners pan out, you know, when the ones that when I've had all my 5% losses and 8% losses, my winners that pan out turn into, you know, 2 and 3 baggers sometimes,
right?
Because I'm just leaving my trailing stop below there, you know? Yeah. And so it depends, you know, I hope I don't sound like I'm flip-flopping, because my system is really pretty linear, you know? And It's like, when I get into something, I'm letting the market take me out. It's either getting to my target or it's taking me out by backing off on the downside.
Yeah, no, it makes total sense. So what I try to do, because obviously I'm not a professional, and you know, if I just make just minimal returns, I'm happy with that. But what I've tried to do is, like, let's use oil as another example, or for an example again. When it got down, you know, I just looked at a historic chart adjusted for inflation back in 2020, and I saw that usually when it gets below 30 a barrel, it's a pretty good time to buy. And then usually when it gets above 80 or 85, you're getting close to a top. You know, it could go a lot higher than that, like 2011 or whatever. But historically, you're close to a top. So I figured, okay, well, when it gets below, you know, 30, 25 a barrel, I'm going to go ahead and buy. And back in 2020, I remember it being right around 20 a barrel. And I thought for sure it was going to go down to 10 at least. You know, I was listening to Macro Voices and my good buddy Eric Townsend. He had a great argument for going to 10. So I thought oil was going lower, but I still went in and bought a ton because it was just under 30 or 25. And that was my rule, is just don't worry about the price. Just buy it when it's cheap and sell it when it's expensive. And so now what I've done is I've just held it, and I was just planning on holding it until it gets up to 80 or 85 and then just start to liquidate. So that's my keep it simple, stupid strategy, right?
I love it.
But I'm also thinking, okay, this could be another one of these commodity super cycles, because I've got a very similar macro view. And I was thinking, well, how would I add to my position and, you know, and take advantage of that dip? And I was talking to Patrick Serezna. I don't know if you know Patrick or not.
Sure, I do. Yeah.
And we were talking about, he was talking about a strategy of selling puts. And I was like, maybe what I do is I just sell puts against my position, or maybe a position I don't have yet. Let's look at like copper. I don't have a very big position in copper. I'd like to really add to that position. I think this is a much better example. And then sell puts to add to your position, knowing that you would love to own copper at a lower price, even if it goes below the strike. But until that time, you might as well just cash flow it and get paid. And then going back to the oil example, I kind of got confused there. It would be just to sell calls. So if it gets up to, you know, that price where I think it's time to sell 85, that strike, then you're selling. But if it's not getting up there yet, you're happy to own it at 60. You're happy to hold it. You're not going to sell it until it gets to that point. So you might as well try to cash flow it in the interim. Is that a good strategy, or am I missing something there?
It's okay if it's for you, right? It's far more technical than I like to get, to be totally honest with you. I've learned that I perform my book and my annual performance is best when I keep it in so much in the same lane that I am literally trading like almost a long short fund, cash only, staying away from options, directional bets, you know, and I'm keeping it really simple. For someone like you, who's more of an investor, I think that you probably do need a strategy that's much different from mine, right? I'm somebody that's way more transactionary than you are. You know, you've had this oil from a long time ago, and now you've got an opportunity to, you know, take some profits in a number of different ways. You can take profits in a way that can keep you in the trade. You can take profits and get out of the trade, you know, like you said, using optionality. So while I think that I think that strategy is fine for you, for me as a trader, it's not something that I would be doing. It's just, we just have different styles. You know, you'll have something on for a very long time. I'm usually much more transactionary related. That's all.
Yeah. No, and don't be afraid to say, George, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of in my entire life.
there's a lot of brain power involved in that, George. You know, I try not to let my lizard brain get away with too much. You know, so I kind of just
Right. I got confused between the puts and the calls. So there you go.
To play shooting gallery.
Yeah, so let me go ahead and push back. I'm sure you get these questions all the time on your long-term inflationary view or dollar going down. I'll just throw you a softball. It's transitory. Okay. What do you say to that?
I think that transitory would be a little bit lazy to lean on, considering our balance sheet, Fed balance sheet just went from $4 trillion to essentially $8 trillion, mm-hmm. showing no signs of stopping. And given the administration that we're in now, using stimulus by the trillions to solve pretty much everything that comes across their plate, I think it's a little bit intellectually lazy to just say, transitory, because it's always been. Right. I feel like that balance sheet story was the most jarring story that I've heard in my financial life. And I think that that is something that I try not to let out of my mind. I think that the Fed balance sheet is going to be something that is, I know they're talking about tapering, but I don't think over time that they're going to be able to do that. And I think that that is going to be in my brain. I'm operating from a premise that the Fed is going to be continually adding to their balance sheet. If that's the case, then I just
government deficit spending.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so you know, exactly. And deficit spending, and you know what they're still doing. You know, we started this emergency program of buying $120 billion of securities a month when we were trying to stabilize markets from reacting to the government lockdowns. Right. We're still buying $120 billion of securities a month. You know, the Fed, they're talking, they're jawboning about potentially laying off that program, but they've shown no signs of stopping and there's no sign of tapering going on. So to me, the balance sheet is still expanding. And if I want to sort of think about and open my mind, say the balance sheet gets to $20 trillion over the next 5 or 10 years without much of a dip, then all the commodity prices on the screen are wrong. They're all too low. Right. That's just the way I'm looking at it.
Don't you think the comeback there, Tony, would be at the beginning of 2008, Fed balance sheet, $800 billion.
Yeah.
At the end of, 2019 or 2018 or, oh boy, even 2016, 17, I don't have the chart in front of me, but Fed balance sheet, $4.5 trillion. And yet that was during, if I'm not mistaken, that was in the middle of a commodity bear market. So
great point.
How do we connect those dots?
Yeah, you know, I think what's different this time is that I just see a continuation of all fiat currency burning around me.
Right.
Right. You know, no matter what, the central banks want to be as accommodative as possible. It seems like the liquidity game that continues to contribute to wealth disparity just continues to go over and over unabated and unchecked. Mm-hmm. So until something happens with that dynamic changing, I'm going to still make a bet that people are going to want to be in hard assets rather than what they've been in and what they've been chasing, which have been the growth stocks, which is all technology and innovation, right? So this is why I pivot and I say for the last, 8 to 10 years, like you said, we've been in this easy money policy. We've been fueling technology. We've been valuing innovators. And that's the way everybody on the block is positioned. And now we're pivoting toward a scenario where, we've added to the balance sheet. It's going to keep growing. The Biden administration adds another $1 trillion in stimulus on its way to signing $3 trillion in stimulus. Right. So we're just, they're just tacking the national debt up to just, unsustainable levels. And it doesn't sound like they're stopping. Yeah. Right. So I feel like we've got another 2 to 3 year window here in the Biden administration where I just don't see anything that has been going on since the trough of the lockdown as changing. I think Federal Reserve stays with their policy. They keep talking about it being transitory. Then we get a couple of headline inflation bombs like we got on February 25th, I think it was, or so when we got that big CPI number that came out. Oh, that was the bond market move on February 25th. We just got the CPI number 2 weeks ago when we got that headline, ex food and energy up 0.9% for 1 month. And, we had a little bit of freak out in market-based inflation expectations, a little bit of sell-off in the stock market, and then we got back on our horse. But I feel like this is, we've crossed the Rubicon on this side of the lockdowns, if George, if that's fair to say. Like, I feel like on this side, we've still got more economic damage to address. And I just think it's going to be addressed with more stimulus. I'm trying to decide if Biden isn't trying to make stimulus like the norm, right? Like helicopter money, the norm, like a new check coming out in 6 months because the economy really hasn't gotten going enough yet. So, you know, I'm on guard for that kind of change. And so with that kind of change, I do not see, you know, over the next several years, I don't see how this hard asset rally lets off, especially if we are going to face a period of higher yields where portfolios are likely going to not value technology as much and have to pivot toward cyclicals, industrials, commodities, materials, and things like that. So I think that that's the big, change that we felt in the last year.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, the way I see it is prior to March of 2020, and I remember this well, I was actually talking to Chris Irons today about it on the QTR podcast. And you'll probably remember this very well because you follow markets so closely. But remember, just the whole market was just falling out of bed. I mean, just absolutely tanking. This was right in March. And the Fed was supposed to have a scheduled meeting on a Wednesday. And they actually had an emergency meeting on a Sunday, I believe, where they dropped rates down to 0%. They announced effectively QE infinity. And then they said they were going to commit to doing up to $1 trillion a day in repo. And if you'll remember, the Monday, the market kind of went up, but then it just fell out of bed again and was down by like 1,000 points or 1,500 points. And basically said, you know what, that Fed put that we've been relying on over the past decade, we don't care anymore. It doesn't matter. It's been deemed useless. And then what happened is the government came out with their CARES initiative and all of the trillions and trillions and trillions of fiscal. And I think that was sometime midweek, the same week. And that's when you saw the market start to go back up again. And that was kind of hit the bottom of the market. Yeah. So we got this new bull trend. And it's almost like the market said, okay, we've shrugged off we've discounted now the Fed put. That's no longer relevant. Now what we need is the government put. We need government fiscal spending monetized by the Fed because that's what affects M2 money supply directly.
Boom.
Directly.
That was my next. I was just going to come with that. I was like, I was going to say
that's the paradigm shift. And that if you look at QE, I mean, Schiff says this perfectly, but you look at QE and it didn't start with QE1. It was just QE because there was only supposed to be one. We weren't supposed to have a 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 infinity. And what happens is you get the economy, the financial economy, addicted to that drug, and it just needs more and more and more. And you can't reverse course or else the whole house of cards comes crashing down. And I think that we've moved. Now we still need the QE. It's not like we can take that away. But now, in addition to that, again, it's just like the drug addict, we need all of this fiscal deficit spending, which is most likely going to have to be soaked up by the Fed to keep the long end of the curve down. And if it is purchased through additional bank reserves and not pulling money out of the real economy in the first place by entities and individuals buying those bonds, then you see that parabolic rise in M2. And if the deficit spending is like the QE in the sense that we need more and more and more, that goes back to M2. And it sounds like you had some thoughts on that.
Well, that's exactly it. I was going to say, you know, they can, you can bet that the Fed put is not going to work anymore until they employ the mechanism of spiking M2 25% in 1 year.
Yeah.
You know, M2, exactly. so it doesn't matter. You know what I mean? When they turn that machine on, you know, you can bet on the put wasn't working. It was working. That machine goes on. The markets are going up. Right. Yeah. So it was very much like just understanding that, okay, they just went, you know, now we crossed the Rubicon. That to me was the big jump when they were, you know, it was clear that they were going to be throwing a wall of liquidity at this. And now we're in a situation, George, where, you know, that M2 has been pent up with nowhere to go with the lockdowns. You know, there's been nowhere to go and spend the money. And now we're starting to open up this summer. So I feel like this summer could be the, you know, it could be the inflationary peak of the short-term inflationary peak of the markets, because all of this money is going to come sloshing back into the system. And, you know, that's going to, you know, accelerate the velocity of money. Once that picks up, you know, then you start building that into a cyclical recovery that's very hard to stop. You know, like the one thing that the other thing that's been very hard to stop is corporate earnings, right? Like, you know, they continue somehow to, you know, to raise expectations, meet earnings, raise expectations, meet earnings. So it's really been an impressive round by the corporate to manage out of this, you know, because they continue to put up decent numbers no matter what. So, you know, that those are the two things that I feel like you're fighting if you want to give up on the Fed put. You know, you're fighting that spike in the money supply, and you're fighting the fact that some of the corporations have, you know, restructured and are in better shape financially, and are some of them are experiencing raging bull markets, right? Like, look at the home builders markets and the corollary retail stocks, et cetera. You know, retail is still the number one sector on the year this year. You know, that's not because, you know, people are home spending their money online, I think. And a lot of these companies are just experiencing windfalls of profits. So, you know, that stuff to me, that's really hard to fight from a bearish perspective in the stock market. I'm kind of a perpetual equity bull, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah. And we're talking about M2, or we're talking about, just that side of the coin, but sort of the demand side, but it's also the supply side, in the sense that all of these supply chains have been disrupted. I mean, how many small and mid-sized businesses are no longer here? Were here in 2019, unemployment rate at an extremely high level. Then when you factor in the amount of people that are actually unemployed, the labor force participation, you see, okay, you know, labor force participation at normal levels. Okay, now the unemployment rate, especially like U6, is up north of 15%, while at the same time, incomes have increased. So by definition, you've got all this demand chasing fewer goods and services. And that means that consumer prices are going one way. And that's straight up. Now, whether that's temporary or not, I think Snyder, I've talked to him briefly about this, and Brent Johnson, and they've got some very good points, because, you know, Snyder is someone that really gets focused on the bond market and kind of what the long end of the curve is telling him. And, you know, I think, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think one of his points would be, listen, if M2 is up by 25% and you've still got the 10-year trading at 1.5, the long end of the curve is telling you that it doesn't expect this inflation to be permanent, or else you'd see that long end go up. And of course the rebuttal is, well, the Fed's buying the whole curve. And I think he would say that, listen, the Fed can try to fight the curve as long as they want, but at some point the market is going to overwhelm them. And I think Brent Johnson, who's another good buddy of mine, might say, okay, listen, Tony, the dollar right now, I agree with everything you've said about M2 and all the money printing and all the deficit spending, and all these things that you're talking about are completely accurate. But the dollar is at 89. Is it 90? So isn't that a testament to the dollar strength, that we can have all of these things that should be dollar bearish, and yet the long end of the curve is the 10 years at 1.5 and the DXY is still around 90.
Yeah, no, you make a great point. And I have to say, George, that this is one of the reasons that I avoid getting into the existential dollar argument, right? Yeah. That's it. I'll say this. I can't even remember the last time I had a bet on the US dollar, right? So all I'm saying is, I look at the dollar, that is my speedometer, right? The dollar is getting smashed. I want to step on the gas on my commodity trades. The dollar is rallying against me and choking me out. I'm probably lightening stuff up and saying, okay, I get it enough. So it's one of those things where I don't want to be in that dogfight of betting whether the dollar is going up, whether they're going to lose reserve status, you know, which I just don't even want to get into that. I want to look at that thing and look at, you, like you said, that the 10-year, and look at the curve and look at break evens and say, okay, that's what that means for commodities, right? Like I don't even.
But see, that goes back to the fact that you understand your time horizon.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know what game to play and what game not, or you know what to pay attention to and what to completely ignore. And that's exactly right. What I think the lesson is for the average investor here. is that if you start with portfolio construction, if you start with understanding your time horizons, understanding your strengths, your weaknesses, and managing emotion, and then look at maybe, you know, what asset you like, that's the secret sauce right there.
Yeah.
Am I correct?
Yeah. You know, it still goes back to about applying, you know, it's different for everybody because trading is a little bit right brain. That's a little bit left brain. But very much like you said, like, you know, the avid blackjack players that we are, it comes down to having your own system that you're comfortable with, you know, and just knowing when, you know, it's really the most important thing. Have your own system that you're comfortable with and decide that, you know, okay, I want to live to trade another day. And usually that's enough to sort of calm yourself down and say, okay, we don't need any hair raising bets right now because I don't see all of these things on the speedometer telling me go, 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 go.
Yeah, and defining what those rules are. I think that's my point is most of the retail traders, they don't have any rules other than just, oh this is going up.
Right, and yeah, you know, it's amazing. I teach a couple of trading apprentice classes to get some guys on the board to understanding how to manage portfolios. And they literally start off with sizing trades, right? That's always everybody's biggest question is, you know, they've got a pot of money and they like this security and they like that and they like that. And they say, well, how do I size this up?
Yeah, right.
You know, and I'm always very much into, well, you know, you have to have very much what you decide is a trading unit so that each position is a trading unit and has its own occupation of space in your portfolio so you can manage it as such. Right. So once you have those trading units of measure, you can say, OK, if my account is now 10 units and I love this trade and I only like this one, then maybe I'll put 3 units into that trade and 1 into this trade. And then manage it as such, right? And this way, you know that if you're going to only risk 5% on a, you know, 1 unit trade, that your portfolio is going to lose 1% of the assets, right? And you start managing it like that, and the math works out, and you say, ah, that's the secret sauce behind managing a portfolio, right? Is managing each trade in a silo of risk management so that you know when to get out of it, because just splashing money across the pot is definitely not the way to go.
Yeah, yeah, very well said. Well, Tony, I know I've taken up a lot of your time here. I sure appreciate it. It's a fantastic conversation. That was really interesting, and I really enjoyed it because it's so rare that I have the opportunity to speak to people that are more traders instead of long-term investors or macro guys and gals. So anyway, for my viewers who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go? Do you have a website or is it just social media?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at TG Macro. My website is tgmacro.com. I'm editor of the Morning Navigator newsletter that I write 4 days a week. And I've got a few other products on my website that you can check out. My email is tony@tgmacro.com. If anybody wants to reach out for me, I'm happy to help anybody with any questions about any of my products or services. I got some pretty happy clients right now though, George. So I'm trying to press the bets a little bit, you know?
Awesome. Well, Tony, enjoy the rest of your day, and I can't wait to do this again.
Yeah, thank you very much for me, George. That was great. I really enjoyed you pushing back on my views. That was really refreshing to have in an interview for a change.
Yeah, and to be clear, I completely agree with you. I just try to always poke holes in my own views, and I'm always just trying to think about what if, you know.
Yeah, that makes you feel better about what you're doing. It's a necessary part of the process. It was really refreshing. I appreciate it, man.
Yeah. All right, Tony, we'll catch you later.
George, thanks for having me. That was fantastic.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.